I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Attorneys general from 15 states and the District of Columbia, all Democrats, filed a lawsuit on Wednesday claiming the Trump administration's action ending DACA, known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was illegal. The Obama-era program gave protections from deportation to children brought to the country illegally if they fulfilled certain requirements. Attorney General Sessions said one of the reasons for ending DACA was a lawsuit from Republican attorneys general who said that DACA was unconstitutional and that President Obama had overreached when he issued the executive order in 2014. Our guest is Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, one of the attorneys general who filed lawsuit this week. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back on with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to walk you through a couple of things in this lawsuit. One of the things that is contended is that this executive order from the president was driven by racial animus. Explain what you mean.
Well, we think that there are a number of problems with this DACA directive. And first, let me say, I think it's important that we have a national conversation and a debate in Congress over immigration reform. And so from that perspective, I'm glad that that conversation was started. The DACA directive, though, that the president put in place, we think violates the law. That's why it took legal action. Mm-hmm. We made a number of claims, the first one being equal protection, that it particularly targets certain groups of individuals. About 80% of DACA recipients are Mexicans. And obviously, we've seen the comments that the president has made about Mexicans in the past, and we've seen some other policies of this administration unfairly target them. That's one claim. The second claim really fundamentally focuses on due process, and that's where I think that is the core, really, of our legal argument here, that these dreamers, these 5,889 individuals in Pennsylvania and about 800,000 across the country, essentially just relied on a promise that the U.S. government made. Not Barack Obama, not mm-hmm. Donald Trump, mm-hmm. but the U.S. government. They said, look, if you pay a $495 fee, you pass a background check, you submit personal information, most importantly, your home address, and you remain a law-abiding individual within our country, we are not going to deport you. What we think is just fundamentally unfair is that they are now in a position to use that information, the same U.S. government, to use that information to target these individuals for deportation. And it doesn't matter what the president tweets or what rhetoric they use about that. What matters is what's written in this DACA directive. And it makes clear that that information can be used. And so that's really the second core claim. And the third core claim here is that it really just violates the administrative procedures, how you go about promulgating rules and regulations. And so that's at the core of this, that a promise was made to these individuals, and that promise is being broken, and it's being broken in an unlawful way.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. Is President Trump using the same kind of executive or presidential authority that President Obama used when he issued the executive order creating DACA?
Marty, I think that's a really interesting question, and I've seen legal experts on both sides say President Obama was well within his authority or President Obama was not within his authority. I think that's an interesting question, mm-hmm. but it's not one that the courts have ever actually reviewed. What is in fact known is that the U.S. government said to these 800,000 individuals, the nearly 6,000 here in Pennsylvania, here's the deal. You do these things, we will do these things. Those individuals are not in a position to judge whether or not President Obama put DACA in place in a lawful way. They had a right to rely on that commitment that was made by the U.S. government. I fundamentally believe that DACA is not the ultimate answer. What is the ultimate answer, and I said this in my statement, is comprehensive immigration reform. Our immigration laws in this country are a disgrace. And Congress, and I'll be very clear, through both political parties, have failed over the last decade, decade and a half, to pass comprehensive immigration reform. It has made us less safe. It has undermined our economy here in Pennsylvania and across the country. And so the one thing I do commend the president for is beginning a real dialogue on comprehensive immigration reform. We need that. What I don't think he can do in this interim period, this arbitrary six-month period that he chose, is he can't change DACA as he did. That is fundamentally unlawful.
Well, I don't want to get too mired in some of the legalese, but let me quote something, and this is from the Washington Post. In 2014, the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel said the program, DACA, was constitutional, but noted that the benefits conferred, quote, could be terminated at any time at the discretion of the Department of Homeland Security. So it seems even back in 2014, under the Obama administration, they were saying this was really a temporary fix.
Absolutely. It is a temporary fix, and it can be canceled at any time, but it has to be canceled in a lawful manner. And what we are alleging in our suit is that it is not being done in a lawful manner. So I think the statement that you read there from the Post is entirely consistent with not only my views, but with our lawsuit. There is a proper way to change rules and regulations and programs, and there's an improper way. In this case, they did not do it by lawful means.
We know what the president said on the campaign trail, but it's been interesting this week to see him, if not contradict himself, sending out several different messages about DACA, that the recipients have nothing to fear, that he loves them. Does that in any way complicate a lawsuit, the fact that you have a president that seems to be all over the place on this issue?
I have learned to put absolutely no stock in the president's tweets. They are oftentimes contradictory to one another, and most of the time he fails to follow through on anything that he tweets. It is obviously a powerful communications tool for him, but at the end of the day, the only thing I put faith in is the rule of law. And the rule of law makes it very clear that while DACA can be ended, and while there should be, as I've said many times in our discussion today, there should be comprehensive immigration reform, the program simply cannot be ended based upon the way in which the directive was, the words in this directive. Those are the words that matter here, and the directive is unlawful.
What do you want the court to do? Do you want them, sort of like the travel ban, to issue a halt of proceedings?
Yeah, effectively, what I would like to see is the court, not to get too legalese here, but basically halt it, stop it. And what I would then like to see is Congress finally do its job. You know, there are actually very few specific responsibilities that Congress has. And I mean that with respect. I don't mean that to sound disrespectful. One of those fundamental responsibilities is to deal with immigration. We need immigration reform. We need comprehensive immigration reform. We need border security. We need these things, and Congress needs to step up and do its job. And so what I'd like to see is have the president's DACA directive put on hold for a period of time while Congress can debate and ultimately and hopefully get a comprehensive bill to the president's desk that he can sign. Then things like DACA won't be needed anymore because you'll have comprehensive and compassionate immigration reform.
What if Congress does actually negotiate this thing and come up with some kind of comprehensive bill, but also ends up supporting the deportation of these DACA recipients? Can you live with that?
I think, look, what matters to me is the rule of law. There are certainly policies that this administration has put in place that I just fundamentally disagree with. And I may use my voice to speak out about that, but I won't file a lawsuit just because it's something I disagree with. I only use the power of a lawsuit like this and affix the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's good name to a lawsuit when law is being broken. To me, and my job as the Pennsylvania Attorney General is to simply uphold the rule of law, not be out there, you know, pontificating about my policy views. If I wanted to do that, I'd go be in Congress, which thank God I'm not. At the end of the day, it is about the rule of law. That's my job. And I will uphold the rule of law to protect the rights and interests of the people of Pennsylvania.
But what do you say to those Republican attorneys general? And they were ready to file a lawsuit saying that what President Obama did was unconstitutional. What do you say to them?
Well, I don't have much to say to them. They're welcome to file whatever suit they want. They hadn't before. I think that's a curious question. And at the end of the day, to the point that I think you made earlier in our discussion just a couple moments ago, there are real questions about whether or not DACA, as it was originally conceived, was lawful or not. The court's never heard that issue. What I know, though, is that these 800,000 individuals had a right to rely on the commitment that the U.S. government made to them. not Barack Obama, not Donald Trump, but the U.S. government. They relied on it, and by taking it away in the manner in which they are under this directive, we believe to be unlawful and a violation of the Due Process Clause.
As you mentioned, and as we know, in order to sign up for DACA, the recipients had to give over a lot of information about themselves, their status, where they live, all of that. Are there things specifically that you and other attorneys general can do if the government begins to use that information against these recipients?
We're going to examine all of the tools that we have available to us and follow the rule of law. And I would hope that Congress will negate the need for us to file additional lawsuits by finally passing comprehensive immigration reform that addresses these questions. Look, I think it's important for your listeners to note that these are individuals, these so-called dreamers, who came to this country really, you know, through no fault of their own. These were babies being carried in the arms of their parents, young children who really didn't have a choice. That choice was made for them by their parents. For many of them, America is the only country they have ever known. This is their only home. And it is important for your listeners to understand who these dreamers are and what they represent and their commitment to enhancing the fabric of our economy and our society. These are individuals who generate $20 million worth of local and state taxes. These are individuals who have to recertify every 2 years and follow the law, because if they break the law, they're no longer eligible for being dreamers. These are individuals who make our schools and universities that much stronger and help grow our economy and invent new technologies. These are individuals who are contributing to the fabric of our society. And by the way, not taking benefits in the process. They're not getting welfare benefits or food stamps or other things like that. And so it's important for us to remember who these people are and also at the same time encourage our elected representatives in the Congress of the United States and the Senate of the United States to finally do their jobs, to bring some certainty and help people come out of the shadows and live in a responsible legal manner.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, but are there then financial reasons for retaining DACA?
Well, we made that argument in our lawsuit that there are not only violations of the law as it relates to the to due process and the administrative code and things like that, but there will also be hardship felt by individual states, states like Pennsylvania, where we have a relatively few number of DACA recipients, 5,889 out of the nearly 800,000 across the country. Yet we still have a serious economic interest in their being here in Pennsylvania. So from an economic standpoint, from a humanitarian standpoint, and most importantly and most critically for my purposes as Attorney General, from a legal standpoint, this DACA directive issued by the Trump administration is wrong, it's illegal, and that's why we're taking him to court.
Well, Josh Shapiro, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He is Pennsylvania's attorney general, one of the attorneys general that filed suit or who filed suit earlier this week, saying that the Trump administration's actions ending DACA, known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was illegal. We're going to take a very short break and talk about something else, Facebook and trolls. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Alex Stamos, the chief security officer for Facebook, told congressional intelligence committees this week that it looks like a Russian troll farm and placed $100,000 worth of ads on their social network during the last presidential campaign. Facebook did not reveal the ads themselves, but said they did not mention candidates by name, but did address social and political issues. Facebook has shared its findings with Robert Mueller, who is investigating allegations of Russian interference in last year's presidential campaign. Joseph Mann joins us, and he writes about cybersecurity and technology for Reuters. And Joseph, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what kind of ads are we talking about that Facebook has revealed to Congress?
Well, there's two sets of ads. The main one, the bigger one, $100,000 worth, were ads that promoted links to sites and Facebook pages that were pretty dubious. In Facebook's terms, they were inauthentic. for example, it could be a site about refugee issues. It could be a site about the secession of Texas. It could be something about Black Lives Matter. But they were all apparently connected to each other, and they were all operated out of Russia. So they're not Americans talking about American issues.
You said there were two sets and another set?
The other set were something that were more directly political. They were not, you know, vote for Trump or vote against Hillary, but they talked about candidates. They were closer to the political line, and where that line is going to be pretty important, because it is illegal for foreigners to spend money on electioneering in the United States. So the question is just how overtly political were they, and we don't know yet.
How long has Facebook known about this? Do we know?
They said they found it pretty recently. They wrote a white paper in April that said there were influence operations on our network. We don't have reason to disbelieve the U.S. intelligence community's conclusion that Russia was trying to influence the election. But they were talking about what they called amplifier accounts. So somebody would say something that was pretty inflammatory, and then an account that was automated, wasn't run by a real person living in Pennsylvania or Indiana or anywhere else, would amplify that, would link to it, and that was part of a propaganda campaign. But they didn't address advertising, like actual money being spent, and that's a bigger deal.
And we're talking about, if you add it all up, something like $150,000. Now, compared to presidential campaigns and what they cost, that really is a drop in the bucket. What is significant about this?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's the first time that a major private entity, in this case Facebook, has said, okay, look, here's objective evidence that Russia was trying to influence the campaign. Now, most people and most people in the government say, yes, Russia was trying to influence the campaign. But President Trump himself has waffled on it. Sometimes he says that wasn't the case, and sometimes he says it's unclear. Here's Facebook, which doesn't really have a dog in the fight, would rather stay out of politics entirely, saying, yes, Russia was apparently spending money trying to influence the campaign. So that's one thing. And the other thing, I think, is it's more detail on the way that it happened. So I think that's really important, because I think a lot of people don't really understand this. They were just trying to whip up sentiment on divisive issues, and they don't really care what the issue is.
Right.
It could be there were some about gay rights. There were some about gun rights. And they, in some cases, were promoting both extreme positions that were opposed to each other. They just want people to be mad at each other and to not trust the other side and to denigrate institutions and the truth itself. And they're just trying to stir this stuff up. So I think a lot of people see a Facebook group that is about California seceding or, you know, something like that, and they don't realize that there are people whose 9-to-5 job in St. Petersburg, Russia, is to post memes that will spread on Facebook on a page like that. But that is really what's going on.
And who is the they? You mentioned someone in St. Petersburg. I read about the Internet Research Agency. Do we know who is behind this or was behind this?
Right. So this is a group, a company. It's changed names a few times. One of the names is the Internet Research Association. It's in St. Petersburg. There was reliable reporting on it. It had about 600 employees. And their job is to comment on all sorts of social media about all sorts of issues and basically echo the Kremlin's position on something, the official government position. They've been doing it for years, both in Russia and in other countries. They're paid for it, and the operation is run by somebody who's a close ally of Putin. That's what the U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded. But that's their job. Their job is to be what the Internet calls trolls, but promote a specific point of view. And you can't tell when you read comments on, you know, the Facebook page or on Twitter or on VKontakte, which is the Facebook of Russia. You can't tell whether those people are just, you know, coming from a certain political view or if it's their actual job. But a lot of them, it's their actual job.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Joseph Mann. He writes about cybersecurity and technology for Reuters. And we're talking about some news this week. Facebook telling some congressional committees, in fact, congressional intelligence committees, that it looks like Russian trollers were placing ads on their social network during the presidential campaign. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. As someone that writes about cybersecurity and technology, does this surprise you, though? I mean, when we see just the amount of hacking that's going on and the amount of trolls at work, does this surprise you?
That's a good question. I think it's one of those things that once it's come out, it seems sort of obvious in retrospect. Why wouldn't, you know, if Russia right. doesn't have rules about spreading propaganda, you know, why not do it? But the level of detail, I think, is very interesting, and I hope more facts come out. What exactly were these fake pages? Facebook hasn't revealed the names of the pages. I know some of them, but I'm not allowed to reveal them.
Well, I was wondering about that. I figured you knew a little more than what you might be telling us. But no, go ahead, Joseph.
They include words like activist and refugee and that sort of thing. But, what's interesting is if you go to these Facebook pages for various issues that are divisive, and you look at the about pages, and you can start to see things that indicate that English isn't the first language, right. or something like that. There was somebody else wrote a story yesterday about the most popular Texas should secede page on Facebook, and it actually has more users than the Texas Democrats page or the Texas Republicans page, and it's all this sort of like sloganeering and cool stuff, but the grammar is off. There's one that says like there's a bunch of cool like Texas shaped things, like a Texas shaped swimming pool and a Texas shaped something else, and it says it was something like I love shape of Texas. It's missing a word.
Right.
You see
right.
something like that, the odds are that it's Russians whose job it is to mess with our heads.
Well, I know this is part of this ongoing investigation. As you said, looks like an associate of Putin is behind some of this. Are we any closer to understanding the role that Putin himself might be playing?
So
maybe only Mueller can answer that, but go ahead.
I think the CIA and the FBI and Mueller have a very good idea, but they are limited in what they want to say because they don't want to give up their sources and methods. So they have information that is based on intercepts of phone calls, emails, live conversations, but they don't want to go into detail about it because that, they might have their sources get, round up and shot or their bugs exposed. I think we're eventually going to find out some pretty concrete evidence there. That's my guess, that the sort of the public will demand it and Mueller will provide it. What we don't have from any of this is any evidence of collusion. So that's the biggest thing. I mean, I think it's kind of accepted that Russia messed with the election. I think most people agree with that. There is no evidence in what Facebook has provided that we know of that suggests any collusion with any campaign. That may come out in some other way. It may, the Democrats suggest that if these ads were highly targeted to, for example, certain precincts in Wisconsin, then that shows that they were getting tipped off by somebody on the ground in the U.S. as to where the possibilities were to move the needle on turnout or something like that. I don't think there's any evidence of that in what Facebook has turned over. If there is, it's something that hasn't come to my attention. Most of the geographic targeting was in 2015, not 2016. And the three quarters of the ads that they're talking about were nationwide. So unless there's something else in there, it's not going to really move the ball forward in terms of collusion.
Has Facebook stopped these ads or been able to stop these ads?
Yes, they have. The ones that they found. There may be others that they haven't found. And that's very much a live issue. I mean, there some in Congress and elsewhere are pretty mad about Facebook, saying that they'd been suggesting that this might have happened a very long time ago, and Facebook is just now saying that they found it and came clean. So people are mad about that. People are wondering if there's more stuff that Facebook hasn't turned up. One of the problems is that a lot of the process of buying ads is automated. You know, if you have a computer in the U.S. and a credit card, you can buy an ad on Facebook. And you can do it without any human intervention. So that also means that it's hard to root out things that shouldn't be there. And they sort of rely on people to complain after the fact. That's why Facebook has gotten in trouble for gun sales and things like that, which are banned by their policy, but which you can get around if you use like code words and things like that. So it's a real problem when stuff gets highly, highly automated. There are people who can beat the system, and it takes other smarter programs to beat it. But the artificial intelligence is behind.
Sure. Is Twitter in any way in trouble, or was Twitter used similarly? Do we know?
So, I mean, it's obvious that Twitter was used by the Russian government to promote Trump and to denigrate Clinton, and that's still happening. And sometimes you can see the trolls, again, mostly automated accounts, you know, part ways with Trump on issues like Syria or something else. And then they'll, you know, or even, you know, who in the White House has been fired lately, they'll be, you know, the Russian trolls will be on the other side of Trump. That happens too. It is hard to say exactly who is a troll and who is politically motivated. And there's definitely, you know, but a real person. There's some of each. One of the problems is that Twitter does not ban automated accounts. So just because something is a bot, or as they call it, short for robot, doesn't mean it's disallowed from the system. So it's a lot easier to have noise on Twitter, and then it's harder work to see how it influences mainstream debate or convinces people of something that isn't true. It's clear that it happens, and Twitter is also having to talk to Congress now and explain what it knows. But I think it knows less than Facebook about its users.
Just to underscore what you're saying, then I do want to talk about a piece you had about a guy named Alexander Vinnick. But so many of us now get our news from Facebook or Twitter. So that does raise some concern.
Big concern, yeah.
Well, let's talk about this Alexander Vinnick. He was arrested. This was back in July, a piece you had this week. A Russian, he was arrested at a Greek hotel in late July. Who's Alexander Vinnick?
So he is accused of being behind the biggest Bitcoin exchange. Now, Bitcoin, as you probably know, is this wildly popular electronic currency. It's been around for years. Many people would say it's there's a bubble in it. There are billions and billions and billions of dollars invested right now in Bitcoin. It's a way to have nearly anonymous money, not actually quite anonymous money, and that's really handy if you are trying to hide stuff from the tax authorities or from your government or from other folks. And unfortunately, it's used. I mean, it has legitimate purposes.
Sure.
You know, you can use it like PayPal. But it's also used to like buy illegal things and to money launder. So he ran the biggest exchange called BTCe, and it's where you could exchange Bitcoin for money for dollars, or you could exchange it for some other currency. There are many other cryptocurrencies now. They're all trying to be a part of this this sort of like new bubble. And it could be very important because by getting this guy and shutting down BTCe. If he actually was behind it, it could lead to some of the biggest ransomware criminals. These are the friendly folks that encrypt your computer or some business's computer and say, send us Bitcoin.
Sure.
Or you don't get your files back, which is annoying if you lose your family pictures or your family files or something like that. But if you are, say, a hospital, is endangering lives. And that's what's been happening. The ransomware boom has caused enormous damage to people's real lives. And this is, among other things, There's a hope that this will lead to who are behind some of the worst rings in ransomware.
You're right. Vinik is now one of seven Russians arrested or indicted on U.S. cybercrime charges this year. And that's more than in past years, raising the question, as you write here, whether President Trump is, on the one hand, not criticizing President Putin, on the other hand, going after some of these criminals. How do you square this or understand this?
Right. So that's an interesting question. So if this was in Russia or some other countries, you would say, the leader of the country is saying one thing and doing another. But in the U.S. still, we do have a line between the Justice Department, FBI, and the White House. The White House can set broad priorities. The Attorney General can set broad priorities. But they are not certainly the White House is not supposed to intervene in any individual case. So they don't do any favors for a campaign donor or anything like that. So our sources in the federal government tell us that these cases grew up from investigations that had been going on and some big breaks in those cases before the election.
So for some time now then.
Yeah. So, I mean, Russian cyber criminals have been a big deal for a very long time. I wrote a book about it called Fatal System Error that came out 7 years ago. So it's been an ongoing problem, and usually the bad guys in Russia don't get extradited. Russia doesn't extradite folks to anywhere for anything, so you have to wait for them to go on vacation somewhere, and then catch them there or have friendly countries turn them over. So there are lots of people that have been under indictment, but we the United States hasn't been able to catch them. The United States has been able to catch more because of some big breaks in those cases. And to be honest, the U.S. FBI is worrying less about cooperation from the Russians. Sometimes the Russians law enforcement cooperates a little bit, and usually they don't. And that's taken a bad turn. The U.S. is getting less cooperation on law enforcement cases, even the ones that aren't political at all. And so I think part of what's going on here is that the FBI is not worrying so much about playing ball, and they're just grabbing people when they can. And so I think that's one of the changes here.
Yeah, we have to say goodbye, and they grabbed this guy at I guess he was on vacation in Greece, and they got him at his hotel.
Yep, that's what happened.
Joseph Min, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well. Writes about cybersecurity and technology for Reuters. And we have a third guest waiting in the wings. We will be talking about the hurricane that is bearing down on Florida. And our guest is Gabriel Vecchi from Princeton University. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The reports and images from St. Martin's, Barbuda, St. Bart's, Anguilla, the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, and the Eastern Caribbean reveal the deadly and destructive power of Hurricane Irma. The news from St. Martin's is that most of the island, about 95%, is destroyed. Irma has been downgraded from a Category 5 to Category 4 storm with winds of 150 miles an hour and is bearing down on Florida. We asked Gabriel Vecchi to join us, professor of geosciences at the Princeton Environmental Institute. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be on phone. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'm sure many people have many questions. I certainly do. Let me give out that phone number. And it's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Gabriel, while I'm talking to you, I have my TV on here. So I'm seeing all the images from Irma as Irma tore through the Eastern Caribbean. How would you describe this storm?
This storm is incredibly intense. It's almost unbelievably so. It's incredibly large, and it is very dangerous still. You mentioned that it was downgraded to Category 4. I wouldn't necessarily focus on the downgrading part. This is incredibly dangerous, and so people should continue to listen to the emergency managers and prepare for it.
And what they're saying, especially if you live, for instance, along the coast of Florida, which is get out, and it sounds like you would agree with that. What has driven Irma? What has created Irma to be such a powerful and destructive storm?
Well, the immediate causes have been a very favorable atmosphere and a very, very favorable ocean. Irma formed over an area of water that was unusually warm in the North Atlantic, and there was warm water extending pretty far down, a few hundred yards down. And it was also over a very quiet atmosphere, and so it was able to intensify quite rapidly. All the conditions were favorable for it, and it has been steering its way westward across the Atlantic since intensifying and maintaining intensity at Category 5 for a number of days, which is very unusual.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's unfortunately one of those situations where the conditions were all favorable. There was nothing in the atmosphere to countervail it. It didn't interact with any large mountains or any large continents, nor did it find deep cold water to drop and sort of cool itself off. So it's just an unfortunate coincidence of a number of circumstances, I would say.
I've seen, I'm sure most of our listeners have seen those aerial photographs where you're looking down on Hurricane Irma and you see that hole, I guess that eye in the center. What's going on in there?
Well, the eye is an area of the storm which is, when you happen to be in it, it is very quiet. It's somewhat still. It's eerie because you've just left a very windy and rainy area has just left over you. And it's an area where air is descending and just quiet there. But it is surrounded by some of the fiercest winds you'll ever encounter, and very, very strong torrential rain.
Have you ever experienced winds of 150 or 185 miles an hour, you personally?
Never in my life, no. I think very few people have, and those that have would rather not have done it.
Absolutely. I was reading in preparation for today's interview about hurricanes. One description was that it's a heat engine. Does that work for you?
Yeah, that's sort of the paradigm by which we understand hurricanes. They draw their energy from the warm ocean, and then they release that by evaporating water. And then they release that energy in the upper atmosphere by condensing that water and causing rain. And so we use a heat engine analogy very often to describe the intensity of storms. This was a theory that goes back a while and formalized most recently by Professor Kerry Manuel at MIT. And in it, you can think of the warm ocean as the fuel. So the warmer the ocean, the more fuel the storm has. And then you can think of the upper atmosphere as the bath, the environment, and the same way that if you run an engine in a cold air, in winter it runs more efficiently, a storm with a colder upper atmosphere is more efficient. So those two factors, a cold upper atmosphere and a warm surface ocean, will give you the most powerful storms.
How do you, and I realize at this point it's hard to predict, I guess, with a lot of certainty exactly where Irma is going to go. But what do you look at to determine the direction of, if not this hurricane, other hurricanes?
Well, hurricanes tend to move due to two reasons. One of them is what we call the beta effect. It is due to the sphericity and the rotation of the Earth. They tend to move in a westward, northwestward direction in the northern hemisphere. In addition to that, they are driven by the dominant winds in the middle of the atmosphere, which tend to blow from east to west in the low latitudes where Irma is right now. And then they tend to blow more from west to east in higher latitudes, which is why you tend to see that storms will do this U-shape, or we call this recurving, where they move from east to west, and then they tend to move from west to east back towards Europe across the Atlantic.
So from what you are observing today, can you tell where Irma's going to go in Florida?
Well, I'm giving my view is that of I'm taking my cues from the experts at the National Hurricane Center. Right. And their assessment, I think, is very correct that it's likely to turn north sometime after it encounters Cuba to the south, and move up somewhere near the southern tip of the Florida Peninsula. the state of Florida. Now, that's where the center will go. It is very important to remember that this storm is very large. And so for hundreds of miles away from that center, people will feel impacts. So it's important to focus on the center, of course, because that's what the winds will follow as an axis. But if you see the forecast for the center not passing directly over you, it still does not mean that you should ignore this. This is very serious. And for hundreds of miles to either side, you should pay attention.
Is this a slow-moving storm? And I feel like it's been on the radar, so to speak, for about a week now.
It's, I mean, it's not an extremely slow-moving storm like Sandy was as it made landfall. But it is moving at a steady pace. I think it's been on the radar for a while for a number of reasons, in particular that the various meteorological centers have been predicting it, and accurately so, for quite a few days. Mm-hmm. And it follows the devastation of Harvey. And so I think a lot of us are attuned to hurricanes. So in that sense, I think it has given us some time to prepare, hopefully, although I think there are a number of people who are worried. I know I have family that is down in Florida right now.
Oh, really?
Some that live there, some that got trapped by missing connections on their flights, having connections canceled.
Oh, that's very worrisome. Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Gabriel Vecchi, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's a professor of geosciences at the Princeton Environmental Institute, and we are talking about Irma. And again, if you have any questions about Irma or about hurricanes in particular, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You mentioned Harvey. Now we're talking about Irma, and apparently Jose is in the Caribbean. Is this a busy hurricane season compared to other years?
This season is quite busy relative to typical hurricane seasons. We have Harvey just passed. We have Irma. We have Jose out in the Atlantic, and then we have Katia the Gulf of Mexico. It is a very active season. We have been for the past couple of decades, since the mid-90s, in what is an active epoch in the Atlantic. The United States has fortunately been spared many intense landfalls over the past few years, but people should still be aware that this is an active era. And there's a lot of scientific debate as to why we are now in an active era. In fact, I'm presently at a meeting at Columbia University topic. Yeah, and there's a lot of discussion because there's the implications of why we're in this era do factor into what we should expect for the coming years.
Which leads to the inevitable question, are we talking about climate change, if we're talking about warmer waters or sea level rise, is that in any way connected to the number or the ferocity of a hurricane?
Well, so we expect that global warming, the warming of the planet and the oceans as we increase greenhouse gases, should lead to fiercer storms in the planet, fiercer hurricanes. Unfortunately, our data going back in time aren't good enough that we can confidently say that it's already happening, but we expect it should be happening. The more recent increase in activity that happened between the 70s and 80s and sometime in the mid-90s, we moved to an active era. The debate right now in the community is between the role of natural ocean variations, where you have currents that move heat northward and southward in the Atlantic, and they vacillate on multi-year timescales, and the potential role for pollutants in the air. Here I'm thinking more sulfates and dust in masking during the 70s and 80s, the sunlight coming into the Atlantic and more recently being cleared out and providing more energy to the Atlantic to fuel storms. And this discussion is important to sort out in the scientific community, because if this is a natural oscillation that we're finding ourselves in, then maybe we will move into a more inactive period sometime in the next few years. However, if this is largely due to changes in pollution and dust, then perhaps this is more what we should expect going forward.
Well, let me pick up on that because that's really interesting. I mean, if there's less pollution, and I'm assuming that's a good thing, it's from environmental regulations and cutting back on pollution, that is or could be creating stronger storms.
Well, I think the way to look at it is that the pollution, the high pollution in the 60s and 70s over the Atlantic may have given us a temporary lull in that where we find ourselves now may be more the norm. That is if you believe the sort of the particulate forcing hypothesis. So I wouldn't say that in the net. So I think that we need to view this recent Atlantic, where it has have something to do with cleaning up dust in the air, as only one of the many aspects that led to. And I think that the public health benefits of having cleaner air are far outweigh that.
A very interesting thing to contemplate. But we do have sea level rise, don't we, especially on certain parts of the East Coast?
Yeah, we have sea level rise, and it's strongest in parts of the East Coast. So even if we are not sure whether global warming has already increased the intensity of storms, we do know that sea level has risen, and in part due to global warming. So the same storm will give us a larger storm surge, which is this bulge of water that tends to follow a storm and causes much of the damage, salt water moving into land. And so even if the storms aren't changing in themselves, their impacts should be more devastating due to sea level rise.
Would it be fair to say that Irma, like past hurricanes, will eventually either die out or reduce its wind velocity once it goes over the land, that the land has that kind of effect on a hurricane?
Yeah, generally the land has that effect on a hurricane. It tends to weaken hurricanes. However, if it goes on land over Florida, Florida tends to be very flat, and so there's not a lot of friction, a lot of drag on the storm as you would get over a more mountainous region. It's also very wet, and so the reduction in intensity over Florida will not be as great as if it made landfall, say, over the mountainous regions, on the west coast of Mexico or elsewhere. So, and as those of us who live in the Mid-Atlantic know, a weak storm, such as what the nominally weak in the Saffir-Simpson scale, such as Sandy was, can have devastating effects. So focusing too much on the wind intensity, I think, it can lead to some false complacency if people do that.
To end on a positive note, I mean, there are advances now in predictions and modeling. Is that some of the good news out of some of this hurricane tracking?
I think that is the good news, that we are having now multi-day. I mean, we've been tracking this storm pretty accurately and predicting its path for almost a week. And I would, and it's not just this particular storm. They have been very good track forecasts this season and the past few seasons. And so hopefully this has helped society plan better and minimize some of the damages. Unfortunately, there still have been some, but one can hope that people will continue to heed the warnings and listen to the emergency managers. In that way, we can take advantage of this technological advances that we've been having.
Well, Gabriel Vecchi, I learned a lot, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Great for us as well. A lot of really good information here. He's a professor of geosciences at the Princeton Environmental Institute. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Hope you found that information helpful. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. Download a podcast. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for the newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, happy birthday, John, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.